And so what drives me is just hearing other people's stories, learning about them. Like, I just don't think there's anything greater we can do as people on this planet than learn from each other, because you only have one life you can live. You're never going to like have the full understanding of everything in the world. The best you can do is listen to other people.
Greetings and welcome to the Unleashed Generosity Podcast, exploring the intersection of faith, service, philanthropy, and community. I'm your host, Aaron Scott. You can listen to all past episodes of the Unleashed Generosity Podcast on our website, unleashgenerosity.org, as well as on any of your favorite podcast streaming platforms. We invite you to connect with us online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm super excited for you to jump in and listen in on this wonderful conversation I had with Mitch Stein, who is the founder and CEO of Pond. Pond is a marketplace where nonprofit organizations can flip the business paradigm and can seek out technology solutions, professional development resources, all sorts of cool things. It's almost like Angie's List for the nonprofit sector, only you get paid for your time when you take meetings. I myself have joined Pond. I took a number of meetings about my website, about various CRM platform tools that I was looking at exploring for Unleashed Generosity. And every time I took one of those meetings, I got paid for my time, to the point to when recently I decided to revamp my website. I took a great meeting with Padron Design Studios, which is based out of Houston. Never would have connected with this company had it not been an opportunity that would have presented itself because of the connection we made on Pond. I said, hey, I'm looking for a website redesign. We had a 30-minute meeting. They talked to me about what we could do. And the best part is I not only got my website completely redesigned and it looks amazing. Hey, go check it out. UnleashGenerosity.org. Not only that, but the website design was completely 100% paid for because I took all these meetings on Pond. So Pond is amazing. You should check it out. We're going to talk about where you can go to get more information on Pond throughout the conversation. But before we jump in, I also want to talk a little bit about the wonderful work that Mitch does and just his passion for the social good sector. We talk a lot about kindness, not just tolerance. And me and you may not see eye to eye on something. And so we sort of just agree to coexist, but that there's some sort of like deeper level of judgmentalism or criticism going on in which we don't fully embrace and recognize the human dignity and beauty that exists in each other. Moving beyond sort of tolerance of one another to a celebration of the goodness and the value that exists in each human being are kind of two different things. And Mitch and I talk about how him growing up as a gay man and realizing he was gay and how he was really harmed in some very tangible and hurtful ways by the church and by religious organizations, and how important that is for me and for those of us that are in faith communities to listen and submit ourselves to hearing those painful stories. And at the same time, Mitch has not gotten bogged down. You know, he's not in a victim mentality. He's moved beyond some of that harmful, toxic stuff that he's experienced. And he still felt drawn to giving back, to showing love and generosity and supporting the social good sector, faith-based and non-faith-based organizations alike, by what he sees as sort of his calling, this mission to be a part of a revolution of kindness and goodness and outpouring change into the nonprofit sector, because he believes that's the catalyst that can really bring about transformation in the world and in so many people's lives. So we talk about some wonderful things, some hard things, some challenging things. And again, throughout this second season, we're unpacking these six core values: humility, hospitality, collaboration, respect, intentional engagement, and then finally, radical imagination. And I think radical imagination in terms of thinking about how the nonprofit sector could and should be different in terms of the way it operates. Pond is one of the drivers, the disruptors of our sector. So welcome in. I'm so excited you're here to learn and listen to Mitch Stein. Well, thank you for taking time on a busy day.
Yeah, of course. Excited to chat.
Good. Why don't we start by, I'd like to, well, I'll do a few rapid fire questions just for fun to get to know you a little bit. What's the best part about having grown up in Indiana?
I would just say kindness in like everything that people do. I just think that as a core fundamental value of my family and community was that you just treat everybody with kindness first.
Awesome. What about favorite restaurant in Fort Wayne? If we go to Fort Wayne, where do we need to eat?
Oh my gosh. Okay. It's not the nicest, but my favorite restaurant is Saboya's.
Saboya's?
It is Saboya's. It's an amazing Mexican place that's like my guilty pleasure to get a big pot of their queso dip and like eat it all to myself with a couple baskets of chips.
Yeah. Well, that definitely is sold to me. Queso is one of my favorites. So even if it's not fancy, that sounds like my kind of place. If you could vacation anywhere in the world, where would you go?
I mean, right now, just about anywhere sounds pretty nice. I'm a huge history nerd in general. So I need to have like, I'm not that much of a like sit on the beach kind of person. I need to have like tours to go on and like places to explore and museums to see. Right. So, I mean, there are so many things on my list. Can I give you the three places that are highest?
Give me your top three. Yeah.
Japan, Australia, and South Africa.
Yeah. Never been to any of them. So that sounds like fun.
Neither.
I've been to China. I've been to Canada. I've been to Mexico. That's about it.
China. I've been to Hong Kong, but I haven't been to mainland China.
I went on a mission trip to China in college for 3 weeks. It was this was 2003. So from what I've heard from other people that have been to China, you know, by 2010, it was a completely different world from when I was there. And I'm sure it's completely different now, just how rapidly things are changing. But yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Sort of social good sector question, and then we'll kind of get into the interview, but what's your earliest memory of volunteering or just doing something to serve somebody?
Yeah, I guess, I don't know if it's my youngest or earliest memory. I guess my earliest is even when we were in elementary school, we used to do like segments of the day where we'd go to a local nursing home and like play games with folks that live there or, you know, read with them or whatever, kind of hang out, play cards, that sort of stuff. So it's probably my earliest, but my most meaningful when I was, I guess it would have been like 11 or 12. My mom's best friend from high school was diagnosed with like a really virulent leukemia. She had been struggling with MS for a long time, and they tried an experimental drug on her, and it like is what gave her this like crazy form of leukemia. And so she only had about like 2.5 months to live after she was diagnosed. And that seeing that when you're like 11 or 12, it's a really hard thing to grapple with and understand why. And I think the only way I could make sense of it was like, I just had this, like, I got to do something. Like, what can I do? I have to do something. So bothered by how unfair it felt. And so I ended up, she would wear these bandanas all the time because she's losing her hair and chemo and stuff. Mm-hmm. And she had a going away party instead of a funeral. Mm-hmm. And at it, she gave everybody one of her bandanas. And so I started a bandana sale where all the proceeds would go to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And we ended up raising about $1,000 in my middle school. So I was like on the local news with one of those big paper checks. Yeah.
That's a cool story. Hard story, but yeah. So you had the philanthropy bug pretty early in life.
Totally.
Well, Mitch, welcome to the Unleash Generosity podcast. I want to start by asking you what you ask all your guests on the Kids Table, your podcast for Pond. Introduce yourself to us and tell us about one or the most important layers of your identity.
Oh, man, my name is Mitch Stein. My pronouns are he, him. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Pond. It's a marketplace that pays nonprofits to discover the best business solutions for their organizations. And in terms of my identity, I don't know that I can pick just one, but I am a gay man. I think it's made me a real like social justice warrior as someone who has experienced some prejudice in my life. I have really taken that as a call to arms to kind of help and stand up for everybody who experiences all kinds of prejudice and discrimination, and recognize my own privilege in a lot of other ways. Sure. So what comes with that, I think, is also a real attempt at least, and a commitment to strive for anti-racism. I think it's something that everyone in the country could do a better job of, for the white folks in particular. And so I'm constantly needing to remind myself of the, you know, if you want to change things that are systemic, it takes constant reminders, and you're going to get tired of it, and it's going to get exhausting. And that is a good thing.
That's all good stuff. And it's kind of peeling back the layers of it, right? That work doesn't ever get done. It's continuously, there's more work to do in ourselves, in our communities, in society. Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, experiencing prejudice. As I mentioned earlier, you grew up in somewhat rural in Northern Indiana around Fort Wayne, which is a pretty politically conservative state. Can you talk a little bit about growing up in that part of the country and any early experiences you had with like organized religion, and what those were like as you, either prior to or as you became aware of your identity?
Yeah, I'll try to not talk for an hour. It's a long, it can be a long answer, but you know, it's, when you're born and raised somewhere, it's all you know. So it's tough to necessarily identify the things that are good or bad or different when you're just experiencing it's all you know. My family, both my parents grew up in Southern Indiana. My mom, much more rural Southern Indiana. I was basically in the suburbs around Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. And although there was like a farm within spitting distance of our house.
Right. So. Rural, pretty fast.
Yes. And my mom in particular grew up, her dad is a minister. She was one of seven. And I think four out of seven all went into ministry as well. Wow. But because of that, they moved all the time because dad was getting placed in different ministries. And so they were moving all over Illinois and Indiana. And so it was really hard growing up, you know, they're living either at the church or in a trailer next to the church. And, you know, we're really, did not have a lot. Yeah. And it might sound ironic given the first thing you asked me about, like, what's the number one thing about growing up in Indiana. And for me, it was all about kindness. But I think there's a lot of layers to, you know, being in a conservative area, religiously, politically, et cetera, kind of all senses of the word. My mom's family, my aunts and uncles, actually also four out of seven of them turned out to be gay or lesbians. That was a really hard thing for the entire family to grapple with in the 80s and early 90s. As everyone was kind of coming out, in particular because I had an uncle who was my mom's twin brother who ended up passing away from AIDS in 1994. And within their family, there was kind of a schism that happened after that between the, like, you know, more religious conservative folks and the people who had since come out and were recognizing some of the issues around their upbringing and how they'd been treated and educated. And some of them wouldn't wear the AIDS ribbon at his funeral because they felt like it was condoning his lifestyle. Mm. And, you know, to have that level of disrespect in his, when you're supposed to be honoring him, I mean, there's just something about that that is so unpalatable.
Right.
And so I think, I just give all that context because that's not even like before I was in the picture. I was 4 years old when he passed away. So I don't remember anything. That was just like there. That was around me when I was growing up and learning about my mom's family or whatever happened to Uncle Marlon or, you know, whatever happened to my grandpa. I never met him. We never saw him. Yeah. We never talked to these uncles. You know, when you're young and you're trying to figure all this stuff out, it's very confusing. And then to layer on top of that, you know, when I was in middle school, starting to like ask more questions about Marlon, because I was like, I know you said he was gay. Like, what does that mean? And then I was recognized, like, I feel like I'm different too. And I don't really know what that means. And meanwhile, you know, we're going to church most Sundays and I'm in confirmation. And we were really taught that being gay is just like being an alcoholic. And we all have our sins that we're predisposed to. And so if if you think you're attracted to the same sex, that means that's your form of alcoholism that you'll have to beat and tackle every day.
Right.
The thought of explaining that to a 12-year-old is just mind-blowing to me in hindsight, because that really set me up for a really, really tough time for about almost 10 years of coming to terms with what that meant. And, you know, I wasn't like outwardly bullied or people weren't like outwardly mean to me. And that's how I get back to the kindness thing. Like in general, everyone is kind.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there's understanding or acceptance or celebration of different people in a way that I think especially kids seek.
Right.
And I think that had a really profound impact on how I grew up and what I valued and how hard of a time I really had getting to know myself as a person, because there was just sort of this like wall in the way there that came from a lot of places. And, you know, there were a lot of contributing factors.
Yeah. I would say that very much mirrors my kind of experience in conservative evangelicalism growing up, was that was kind of the way that homosexuality was framed, was as this sort of crucible that some people have to bear. But the idea that even entertaining different interpretations of, you know, the clobber passages or whatever, we didn't even talk about like, so maybe these folks are called to a celibate lifestyle and alternatives. It was really pretty harsh and critical. Like, this is a sin. Well, I'm sorry that you had that experience. I think you told me when we talked earlier too, that you had was it your grandfather who was the minister, was pretty outright bigoted against people who were homosexual orientation.
Yeah. You know, I don't know a lot about my grandpa, to be honest. I mean, I just know that no one was a big fan of him. I think a lot of that came from being pretty dogmatic and strict. You know, my mom got her mouth washed out with liquid soap for telling her brother shut up when she was 13. They couldn't play any game that involved dice because it was too close to gambling.
It was kind of fundamentalist.
Just like, for what? What is the point of this?
I mean, do you remember feeling like you were brought up in the church and you were brought up, you know, with religion being a part of, you know, an important part of your formation, going through confirmation and whatnot, but then having these experiences where you realize I'm a gay man, but then these are all the things I've been told about what that means. So that this really isn't a community I want to be part of anymore, or that I don't feel welcome here? Or what do you recall kind of thinking or feeling?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it wasn't like there was a point in time where I was like, rah, I'm out of here. It was fairly gradual. I also just think, you know, I'm, as I mentioned earlier, like huge history nerd. And I was just like obsessing over history when I was in college and reading like everything I could. And it just doesn't take a lot of reading of history to get a bit disillusioned with organized religion. And so I think that like that coinciding with my own, it was like I had the personal level of like, well, they're telling me I literally don't belong here if I'm going to be me, or I need to change who I am. And by the way, like, what's the point? Look at all these horrible things, you know? So there was sort of these like that confluence of like the intellectual and the personal experience that I just think over time, it just kind of like phased out in a way that is hard to, I can't really put a pin in exactly at what point in time that was.
So for a lot of people, I mean, their faith or their spirituality is at the heart of what drives them to do the work that they do. And obviously that wouldn't be the case for you with organized religion. Maybe we can talk more about, you know, sort of the spirituality and some things that ground you in terms of helping you feel cared for and whole. And since that, you know, organized religion isn't your why, so to speak, what are some things that you do find inspiring that, you know, your drive to want to do the work that you do, and that made you want to, you know, start Pond in the first place and get engaged with nonprofits and philanthropy and volunteerism?
Yeah. And I, first of all, I love the way you asked that question, because I think it's really important for everyone to realize that people, there's a variety of motivations people can have to do good, and like, right. we should celebrate them, you know, and thinking or adhering to like one way to be a good person or do good in the world is rather limiting. Mm. So I just appreciate you for asking the question. Mm. You know, I think for me, I just love people. Like, I love being around other people. I get so much energy from people. I love meeting new people. I love hearing their stories. I think if you take the time to listen to someone for 5 minutes, you just learn just the richness of other people's lived experiences. And so I just try to spend my time. I don't want this to sound harsh. To me, the idea of preaching as opposed to listening isn't a good use of my time.
Yeah.
I just want to learn from others. Like I said, history nerd, I think that just comes from me being like insatiably curious. And so what drives me is just hearing other people's stories, learning about them. Like, I just don't think there's anything greater we can do as people on this planet than learn from each other. Because you only have one life you can live. You're never going to like have the full understanding of everything in the world. The best you can do is listen to other people. And I think that attitude crosses so many different parts of life. You know, if you're going to be a good partner to someone, it's about listening to them and understanding them, not about telling them things. You know, if you're going to be a good friend, if you're going to be a good community member, right? If you're going to be a good civic servant, if you're going to be a good business person, right? Like, how many successful business people go out and tell their customers what they need instead of listening to them, right? So it's just, for me, that is a fundamental philosophy that talk about who's going to run a successful fundraising event who doesn't listen to potential donors of what's interesting to them, how they want to be contacted, how, like, what types of events they want to do, what type of work do they want to be involved in, how do they want to volunteer? Like, everything comes back to listening. And so to me, that's what drives me. That's what anchors me, is listening to others.
Yeah.
And it is a bit of a religion for me. It's just other people.
What's that posture of humility? I'm sure for you as a CEO, that posture of humility. I mean, if you don't take the input from your employees, if you're not asking them, how are they doing? Like, what ideas do you have? That's going to reflect the type of company you run, the kind of leader you are. I've got all the answers. I don't need, you know, that. So that, as I've thought about like this podcast, and just one of the values I want to embody is the sort of that posture of humility where, like, I don't have all the answers. And so every person that comes on has their own experience, has their own background, and I want to learn from them. And many of the people that I find myself attracted to, I think, are people with that same disposition and posture that you have, that say the same thing. They're not coming on like, oh, let me tell you how it is. Well, let me tell you all the solutions to the world. Like, it's too complicated to be black and white. There's a lot of gray, and we come to better conclusions by like dialogue and collaboration.
And I was going to say, there's a quote that I use. I've literally already used it twice today on other calls. I really wish I knew who to credit it with. It wasn't me who came up with it. But I just think about it constantly, because we're all seeking advice, right? And even on podcasts, the favorite question of people, what's your advice? What's your advice for people like you? What's your advice for whatever? And the quote is, there is no such thing as good advice. There are only good stories. Hmm. And I just think that is the most powerful mindset to be in as a leader, or as a, you know, more junior person, or, you know, whatever, wherever you stand in the organization.
Yeah.
No one has the answers for you. And if you ask them for the answer, it's not actually going to be helpful. And this is something that you learn in customer discovery and product building. There's an amazing book called The Mom Test. And the whole point of the book is, when you have a startup idea, you don't go, hey mom, here's my idea, what do you think? Because what's she going to say?
That's amazing. You should do it.
Sounds great, sweetie. You can do anything you want.
Right.
And so that's not how you actually make progress. Yeah. If you had asked, let's say your idea was, the example they give in the book is like creating an online cookbook recipe platform.
Sure.
And instead ask your mom, hey mom, when was the last time you used a recipe?
Right.
Where did you find it? How long did it take you to find it?
Yeah.
You know, was it frustrating? What was the easiest part about it? What did you love about it? What did you hate about it? Like, you learn, you ask questions to learn instead of tell.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you find that faith-based organizations or churches or whoever are working with you, do you find that they're equally open to kind of having that posture of curiosity and wanting to learn as opposed to that? Because I think that, you know, that's not unique to Christianity, but any faith-based organization, if they're in the business of preaching and telling people what to believe, as opposed to curiously wanting to get to know people and learn from their experience, that's a different sort of posture.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, Aaron, I'm hopeful in this podcast and in your network that we're able to get engaged with more faith-based organizations. It hasn't been a giant cohort of user based on Pond yet, but I know it's a space where there can be a ton of improvements in, you know, how they're running the business of the organization and the technology they're using. And that's exactly what Pond is for. So I would just put that out there at the outset that we're excited to and look forward to working with all kinds of faith-based organizations. I don't want that to get misconstrued in this conversation at all, that there is a ton of amazing good done by so many of these organizations, and that's what we're here to support. I've gotten close to a number of folks who either themselves are, you know, more religious, or their organizations do have a faith-based element to what they do. And I don't find that it precludes, maybe it's just selection bias. So the people that are coming to us are like, you know, we want to learn from you. This is what you do best. And that's why we're talking to you. And we want our organization to be more successful, and I want to use better tech, and I don't know where to get started, or what type of consultant should we use? I don't know what platform to be on, like all that stuff.
What kind of got you started on the idea of launching Pond? I mean, did you have an experience like volunteering or serving on a board, or like, what was it that first kind of planted the seed of the idea of Pond? And then I want to talk more about Pond, because I think it's really, the first time I heard about it, I think I heard you on somebody else's podcast, and having worked in the nonprofit sector for like 10 years, I was like, this is amazing. Like, this is the coolest thing ever. I was so excited. So I want to give you lots of time to just talk about you guys and what you do, because I think anyone listening would really benefit from getting on Pond. It's free. Not only is it free, they're going to pay you to be on it, which is, again, flipping the paradigm. But what was the first sort of seed that made you kind of start brewing and stewing over this idea?
Yeah, you know, I would have always described myself as a leader. And I found in class projects, I was usually the one everyone would like look to present, and that's which I think are early indicators of entrepreneurship. But for me, I got involved with an organization called the LGBT Center of New York. Mm-hmm. They're the second largest LGBT center in the world. They offer a number of healthcare services targeted directly at the LGBT community in the broader New York City area, including HIV testing and treatment and treatment navigation, as well as lots of education and prevention work, substance use and abuse treatment dedicated for young people and for queer people. And they also serve as a kind of an arts and culture institution. It's a physical building, super historic landmark in the middle of the West Village, right next to the AIDS Memorial. So just, it's an amazing organization. It was started right in the middle of the AIDS crisis in the early 80s as part of ACT UP, and just it really grew in Boston from there to encompass more of the community. They have an event every year called Cycle for the Cause. And so it is the Northeast AIDS ride from Boston to New York. And in 2016, my dad and I joined the event. Actually, my dad signed up first, which is kind of funny. And we did it because of my mom's twin brother, Marlon, who had passed away from AIDS. And I had a friend who was doing the ride and encouraged us to join. So we didn't really have a lot of expectation going into it. But by the end of that first ride, spending 3 days on the road with hundreds of people, most of whom are, you know, are part of the LGBT community here in New York area, it was just so fundamentally game-changing for my family. And, you know, for my dad, I think a lot of discrimination just comes from lack of exposure. Mm. And I think him being really immersed in a community and seeing how loving and powerful at all was just completely changed his, and we were good before that. Like we weren't, you know, when I first came out, it was a little bit tough and there were some things said that I think both my parents would take back today and take good, but you know, we've talked about it and moved on and everyone's, you know, grown from there. But I could just tell a fundamental shift after that ride that there was like a deeper understanding of what was missing in my life. And how, what important role community where people see themselves in the community plays in just living a full life. And I just bring all that context up to say like, it deeply moved me to be a part of that. Not to mention we've over 5 years raised over $400,000 for the organization. So we were doing tons of fundraising. And through all that process, I ended up joining the board at the center and getting more involved. And they went through a tech switch where they were like looking for a new platform. And it was my first time seeing this firsthand where I was like, so what's, you know, what's the process like? Do you use a certain, is there a website that like helps you identify everything? And they're like, oh no, you know, we just have to call some friends and then, you know, they might make a recommendation. So then I'll just like Google around on it for a while. And then we'll do a bunch of demos and then they'll need to come in and pitch us and they'll put together like a special deck. And I'm like, a deck? You're making them put a deck together? It's this like an out of the box software. And you know, but it was nothing about them. Like the more I heard about it, this is just what was happening literally everywhere.
Right.
And everyone, it became, I think most founders have that like reason they couldn't sleep at night type moment. And for me, it was like, I was frustrated when I heard that maybe this was challenging for them or they were wasting time or whatever. But the center is a pretty big organization and they have staff to manage that. And it just became clear to me that it's a matter of efficiency for a place like the center, but for the 80% of nonprofits that are under $1 million a year in revenue, it's just complete lack of access. And I would just hear from more people I asked about it, this like blasé attitude of, well, yeah, but it's a nonprofit. Like, yeah, of course they have bad tech. Like, yeah, it's like 10 years behind because
they like don't deserve good tech or something.
You know, like I would literally hear that all the time from people. And it just made me absolutely like infuriated. And I mean, not to mention the fact that I'm like, look, I'm out here asking people for like thousands of dollars and you're telling me that like, I'm supposed to just represent that like they should be okay with their money maybe not being spent as well as it should because it's a nonprofit, so who cares? I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And then I started digging more and I was like, holy crap, this is a huge segment of the United States economy. Right. Like they're spending $1 trillion a year, $1 trillion a year by almost 2 million organizations employing 23 million people. And yet I had people telling me, well, yeah, of course they don't need anything nice. It's a nonprofit. You know, it's just like, I just felt like there was this disconnect and it drove me crazy to the point that I decided, you know, I at the time was covering the technology space as a banker. So I worked with a lot of software and internet businesses. We were like taking them public or, you know, companies merging or selling themselves. And I worked with a lot of these large marketplaces and especially consumer marketplaces for big ticket consumer purchases. So what I mean by that is like cars, homes, travel. And they talked a lot about how they transformed those industries. Now this time it's like kind of old news, right? Of course you book your trip online. But think about in the 90s, early mid 90s, what would you do if you wanted to go on a trip to Paris to the travel agent? And like, how do you know if they're giving you the best price? I guess you go ask someone else, you go talk to a different travel agent. Like, it's crazy to think about how different that was. And, or cars is an amazing example. Today, right now, while we're talking candidly, like while you're asking me a question, I could go buy a car on Carvana. And spend $50,000 and have the car delivered to me in a few hours and not think twice about it.
Right.
I mean, of course I would need $50,000 in this example to make that possible, assuming I did have money available. And so but then think back to like the early 90s, how would you buy a car? You would pull out a newspaper, maybe look it through some classifieds, go take yourself to different car lots, have no idea if you're getting ripped off or not. Just like ask a friend if they know a mechanic or someone they can trust to physically look under the hood of the machine. So I just give all these examples to say, like, compare those where we are today. The nonprofit sector is in the car lot.
Right.
And even though it's that this huge, enormous space, tons of people, tons of money being spent, there is no central marketplace. And that was what inspired Pond, was like, how do we make this happen? It's a really tough sector. It's super fragmented. You know, every group of churches in every city has their, they're all their own separate group. Like, how on earth do you start penetrating and getting that whole audience engaged, you know, to help themselves and help each other?
Yeah.
And so I guess I'll pause there. That is the beginning. And quick side note is I quit my job on March 6, 2020. And then the entire world shut down about 5 days later. So I moved home back to Indiana with mom and dad. So the first 2 years of the company was truly the startup out of the parents' garage situation in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
The entrepreneur journey from people I've talked to and all the things you read is challenging in its own right. But on top of it, I'm trying to launch this company during a global pandemic and I'm going to live with my parents, you know, just to make a go of it. Yeah. So, I mean, mad props to you for your stick-to-itiveness and your drive to drive through it. I want to go back to one thing you said, though, about like the 23 million people. You know, I don't think most people, even working in the nonprofit, I didn't realize like what percentage of the American workforce works in nonprofits and how big of a chunk of the economy this is. So I think a lot of like those comments of like, oh, it's just the nonprofit, a lot of that is a lack of awareness of how robust a part of our lives, our economy, our communities, nonprofits are. And like you said, there's a lot of diversity too, like different religious organizations, faith-based organizations, you know, churches or mosques or synagogues, plus all the social service organizations and quasi-government and there's just layers and layers and layers of all this. And it's not an insignificant part of the way our world works. So finding efficiencies and ways to make this sector of our lives work, again, just struck me as so powerful. So tell us, how does it work? Like, I want to get on Pond right now. Why would I do that? And what am I going to encounter when I get there?
Yeah. So Pond, you can think about it a lot like Angie's List or Thumbtack for the nonprofit sector. So it's like, you need something, you might need software, you might need a new consultant or an agency or someone do some contract work for you, or find some training. It really runs the gambit. But the whole point is, you maybe don't even need to know what you need.
Right.
You can just come to Pond and share what your problem is, because it's our job and our community of providers' job to, you know, find solutions and bring them to you and take the work out of your hands. You put the project up, and it's our job to bring providers to you that could solve that problem. You're able to see those requests or proposals and see, like, you know, what they do, why they want to talk to you, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And you can go through and manage that all centrally in your own profile. And, you know, you're not getting emails from these people, which I appreciate everyone's afraid of. It's secure. They are. And the whole point is, you can review that there. And whenever you want to engage, you can, and do it super simply through the platform. Yeah. And on top of all that, it's free to join. And anytime you talk to someone, you're going to get $100 in your account just for having the conversation. You're going to make money for it instead of just spending a bunch of time for no reason, you know, and getting nothing in return. So it is a complete shift in how those search and selection processes happen for people today.
Yeah. And when I first like became aware of it, I think I reached out to you to just have I was asking you some about your entrepreneur startup journey, because I wasn't sure what Unleashed Generosity might become, if it would start as a podcast and maybe grow into something bigger. And it still might at some point, I don't know. But I was really curious, because again, as I think about, you know, like, well, what do you do with your podcast? How do you do social media marketing? Maybe I need some website help. There was all those questions. I don't know what it is I need. So the idea of like, I could come on a one-stop shop and just kind of like throw out three or four different possible project ideas. The idea that then vendors would be coming to me, not with like a, you know, filling my inbox with like, here, we do this, we do this, we do this, but like a specific person saying, give me 30 minutes of your time and you're going to get paid for it. I was just blown away. Like, yes, that's flipping the paradigm. Like, that's exactly what nonprofit leaders need, because they're busy. Their time is so valuable. They're on a shoestring budget. So if you actually get paid for your time, explain how that part works. So like, I took a meeting with somebody, I get $100, it goes into my Pond account. How do I use that money then?
Yeah, so your account on the platform, you can use it with any of those providers or vendors that you're meeting with. That's kind of like the first order obvious thing you can do. So you find a solution that you really like, someone that's going to help you set up your podcast or manage, you know, a platform to manage your social media or whatever it is. But in addition to that, it's a real strategic priority of mine in particular for the next few months is expanding the value of the currency on the platform. How do you do that? It becomes more valuable by having more ways to earn it and more ways to spend it.
Yeah.
And I think that's also really critical in community building and getting ongoing engagement, because the truth is, software or, you know, new service providers, it's rather episodic. You're not like looking for that every day.
Right.
And can we create more ongoing community around the things that you are looking for on a daily basis, which are, you know, thought leadership, content, training, connection to others, attending conferences, one-on-one time with an expert to answer a point in time question. Right. So all those things are going into our prize wall, if you will. It's like if you've been to a Chuck E. Cheese or Dave and Buster's, you go, you're getting all of your tickets. Why do you care about getting those freaking tickets? Because you look over your shoulder and there's like a giant stuffed teddy bear. But in our case, we actually want it to be something valuable instead of a stuffed teddy bear. But the idea is like, you are getting rewarded for your time, and those rewards, you have the dignity of choice in how you want to redeem them. It's not just a coupon or like a 10% off gimmick. It's like, no, this is actual dollars that you can go spend on a new tool, a new service, a admission to a conference, like all these things within our ecosystem. And the way we power that is because anyone who's a provider within the ecosystem, Pond has a channel partnership with them. So when they make the sale, just like when someone sells you something through Amazon, guess how Amazon makes money, right? They're taking like a percentage of it. Right. So Pond does something similar with our providers that are making sales through the platform. We take between 10 to 20% of what they're selling, but that kind of referral or channel partnership fee is what we pool together to then credit our members.
Yeah.
And so it's a much more virtuous cycle that like we, you know, trying to make sure that marketing and like that sales and marketing dollar doesn't just get siphoned off by Google and Facebook, but it's actually building and driving the infrastructure for the sector and increasing access, because we're really, what ends up happening is a few purchasers who buy more expensive stuff through Pond, so big organization making a six-figure consulting agreement or software contract. In a lot of ways, that kind of subsidizes increased access for smaller groups and organizations that are going to be at lower price points and saving a greater percentage on their purchase.
By the time people listen to this, they won't know that today was a big day, like, because it'll be, you know, weeks later. But today was a pretty exciting announcement for you all in terms of achieving a milestone of success. Well, tell us about it.
Yeah. So we announced that we just closed on a $1.5 million investment from a handful of investors. You know, I'm in a startup group where someone likes to say all the time, startup is or fundraising is not success. You just get obsessed with fundraising and you think that means you're successful. It's not. And I had to stop them and be like, whoever said that never sat and looked at the end of their startup 2 weeks from now if you don't get money in the door.
Yeah.
Okay. So it absolutely is. It's not the end all be all, but as you said, it's a really important milestone. And especially when you're trying to start a company, a marketplace is so hard. It is not just a standard business where you like get a $1,000 small business loan and set up your lemonade stand and you'll pay for it. You know, doesn't work like that. You've got to hit real scale and like escape velocity.
Right.
And you cannot fund it through the operations. It just does not work, because anything you do to monetize too early is limiting your growth. And the growth of the network is the only reason that there's value in a marketplace.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't work. Like, it is a critical part of starting this kind of business. So yes, it is. It's a really exciting day. We're, you know, hiring some new positions, and we've got a great team in place that we're excited to pay a little bit better because they've definitely been, and me included, taking a bit of a hit on the pay front, just, you know, because we obviously believe in where the company is going. So it's still rather early days, but we have, you know, over 350 nonprofits that are using the platform, and about 180 different vendors, and it's growing a lot every day.
Awesome. Well, I hope that this contributes to some of that growth, and some people that haven't heard of you, check it out. Where do they go to find you?
Yeah, joinponds.com is the site. And like you said, it's completely free to join for anyone involved with the nonprofit. And if you have questions either about the site or just like things going on at your organization, I am a completely open book and have a totally open door policy. So my email is Mitch, M-I-T-C-H at joinpond.com. And I'd love to chat with anybody about what you're struggling with or any ways we can help or what we could do better. I would also just say that I'm super active on LinkedIn. So definitely connect with me there. And I love to engage with people there. So we've got a pretty thriving community and of folks in the nonprofit market engaged on LinkedIn too.
Yeah. And I'll affirm that. I'm trying to remember which podcast it was I heard you on, but I reached out to you, I think, through LinkedIn and just messaged you. And it was within, I don't know, an hour, 20 minutes, you messaged me back. It's like, hey, great to connect. Like, yeah, let's jump on a Zoom sometime. So you don't, I've heard John and Becky with We Are For Good say this, like, you don't often hear CEOs of companies just giving out their personal email on a podcast saying, like, not go through like my person, but like, yeah, just email me directly. I'll be glad to chat with you. So I appreciate how accessible and approachable you are. And that was my experience for anyone who's listening. I reached out to Mitch and he immediately was like, yeah, absolutely. I'd love to chat. And we connected. And part of that's what led to us being being in touch with a few Zoom calls over the last year and me joining Pond and me following your journey and wanting to have you on to be able to share this with other people. I want to go back to one other thing too, that you said earlier about how, when you were doing the race and the ride, about how you were raising thousands of dollars for the organization, but how transformative that was for you in terms of finding community, but also bringing like just a new dynamic to the relationship with your dad and your family. I think so often we think about whatever we're doing, like volunteering for an organization, that we're the ones giving. And you hear people's cliche say like, well, I got so much more out of it than I actually gave. But that can really be true, and not just sort of throwaway little ways, but like literally in your experience, like part of that transformed your life in significant ways.
Without a doubt. And I also think this goes back to the, you know, we have a bit of a mantra at Pond that nonprofits are powerful.
Yeah,
I can't stand to hear people be like, oh, yeah, but they work at a nonprofit. What'd you expect? It's like, I'm sorry, like leave that crap at the door with me, because it's just not true. And I'm so sick of people underestimating folks that work in the sector, and the sector at large, because to your point, like me working on the fundraising, I learned more about storytelling, about messaging, about marketing, about community building than I ever did in any class or a single minute doing a job as an investment banker. And the skills that I got from my volunteering and fundraising and board service have been infinitely more valuable in building a company than anything I learned as a banker. So I just think it's so short-sighted to lose sight of the skills and experiences that you're going to gain. First of all, you can really gain anywhere. I mean, that's like part of the problem, I think, in the sort of jobs employment cycle, is that you're like looking for boxes to be checked instead of like learning from people about what their experiences bring. But in particular, in the nonprofit world, I think, I mean, I've just met so many amazing people who either got their start in the sector or are still there, and they get discounted. They get, you know, underestimated. And that was the whole reason we named our podcast The Kids Table.
Yeah.
Because it was just a name that anyone that's worked in a nonprofit kind of does one of those. Yep. Been there. You know, like, I get it. And a lot of the message of our interviews is like, the audience, yes, obviously other nonprofits can learn from nonprofit leaders' journeys, but like, business leaders should be listening more to nonprofit leaders. They have way more to learn from the nonprofit sector. And getting back to our original whole discussion around preaching, how many people have you heard either at the board level or a volunteer be like, oh, well, in business, let me tell you, nonprofits should run more like a business. If this were my business, this is what I would
work.
As if they're on,
yeah.
Like, let me tell you how this works, as if they're on some like pedestal because right. they think they're special because they have a single P&L to think about as opposed to multifaceted impact across like 12 different stakeholder bases. It's a lot more complicated than selling car fresheners, right? Like these are people's lives, livelihoods, health, education, their families on the line.
It is funny when you engage with some board members, like what their sense is of what they're supposed to be doing. And maybe that's equally the fault of we haven't trained like people to say, here's what we need from you, or here's what we want from you, or here's what role we want you to play. I think boards are underutilized, but I think one of the dynamics for sure is that like the boards think, oh, like I'm here to provide my expertise and to make sure this organization stays fiscally sound. And, you know, they're going to ask me for everything I want. Like, yeah, some of that, but you might have some things to learn too about the cause that you're helping to support, or, you know, like these are complicated problems. Nonprofits are trying to cure cancer and care for the LGBTQ community and deal with addiction and, you know, war and peace, yeah. The environment and global warming. Yeah. It's really simple problems, right?
Well, what people lose sight of is like the reason the nonprofit sector exists in such a robust fashion in the United States is because we have all collectively agreed that a capitalist society is the best, and low touch government is the best thing for the world. Okay, we all very quickly realized that left a lot of gaps. And so we all just agreed like philanthropy is just gonna spring up and fill all those gaps. And guess what lives at the gaps? The hardest things that can't be solved by our existing organizations and structures and businesses,
yeah.
Right? And by the way, a lot of those organizations, structures, and businesses are probably creating the gaps in a lot of ways. So it's like, it is a moving of a mountain kind of job. And so I couldn't agree more with that. And just one thing on the board dynamic that I've seen a lot at different organizations is I also think that there's a bit of boards change over and staff changes over. And so there's like this kind of generational trauma,
yeah,
of a board member has been at different organizations. They've seen how this works. They've seen, oh, well, they're just going to leave in a few years anyway. Let me tell you how you need to do it. Like there is a almost like a loss of compassion from the board. And from the nonprofit perspective, it's just like, boards are almost, it's almost like I want to avoid. They're like there and they're going to help. They're going to like bring, they're going to give us some money, which is great. But beyond that, I just want to talk to them as little as possible.
Right.
And I don't want them getting in my hair. I've seen this before. They're going to be a huge distraction. So like it best to just not even engage them. Or people have told me before they wanted to help, but they didn't really mean it. So like I said, there's this I see on both sides of that dynamic. People applying their own trauma sounds like a little harsh, but you know, like past negative experience into this current setting, which is unfair. That's just bias, right? That's bias you're bringing into a new relationship. And I completely agree with your point that you should just start off those relationships with like, let's clear the air. This is how we want this to work. This is what I do. This is what you do. Let's have an open dialogue.
Right.
What do you want to do? How are we going to hold each other accountable? Two-way street, well, that's hard to do
right.
when that board member is coming on because you wanted to get a $100,000 check from them.
Right. Or them introduce us to all their rich friends or whatever.
Yep.
And and again, if it's seen as transactional by the board member, if they're just like, well, my employer just expects me to be on some sort of volunteer board, or, you know, like, well, yeah, I feel like this is something I should have to do, but I can really only commit 1 hour, you know, every 3 months to come to a meeting. It's like, well, I don't know how substantially you're going to be engaged with our mission if you just come to a meeting once every 3 months. Like, we're really looking for people who are passionate about our cause and want to get engaged. And and I've seen that. I mean, from my mentor who kind of got me into the nonprofit sector, I mean, he said the biggest asset is your board and the biggest headache is your board, depending on if they, you know, are really in your corner and have your back or not. And I've seen that too. I mean, we have some really great board members with Salvation Army where I'm at right now, not just, you know, helping us financially with securing, you know, gifts or identifying donors, but also giving of their time. You know, they came out and gave a lot of time during our Angel Tree program. You know, they were packing gifts for kids. So that's cool when you see people rolling up their sleeves right alongside you and saying like, this organization matters to me. The impact we make in our community matters. And I'm going to show that through my investment of time. Can I ask you a couple of quick, you know, questions and
clarity? Yeah.
So we started with a few rapid fire. We'll close with a few rapid fire. So some of these are might be a little bit less get to know you fun and a little more reflective. So this idea of humility, I want to put it to the test here, right? what's something that you're pretty sure you thought you knew, but now you're not so sure anymore?
Like everything. I really thought I knew like team building. Like I'd had so many interns and interviewed so many people at Goldman, and I'm like a people person. I've been like a team leader in high school and college. I was an athlete, like all these things. And I think once you actually have your own company and also I'm 31, like I just think realizing how little experience you've had managing, hiring, firing, like that stuff just really blindsided me, both in terms of like how much I have to learn and how difficult it is and how emotionally draining it is. Like the work is so taxing to work with dealing with people. And it's the single most important thing at your company or organization, but it's absolutely the hardest. And I completely underestimated that. Mm.
Tell us about a time you got something wrong.
Again, all the time. For Pond, what we're doing today is like the fourth iteration of this thing. Mm. So, I mean, I think initially I tried to, maybe this goes back to the whole comment of like advice versus stories. Yeah. I tried to just replicate what Expedia looks like for the nonprofits without thinking about the difference in the audience and the difference in agency, right? So when I'm booking a trip or I'm buying a car or I'm buying a home, I know what I need a car for, right? I need to get from A to B. I need a new car. I know why I need a car. I have a timeline for when I need a car. I know how much I can spend or borrow to get the car, right? It's just like, and it's for me, so I'm going to go do it when I need it, right? It's just like so much more agency. And yet there, it's so much more complicated on the nonprofit side. So I think that was a big mistake, was oversimplifying and relying on a precedent.
I found this on the web.
Siri is getting involved in our podcast. Relying on a precedent.
All right, last one. We've talked a lot about listening to other people. Who or what group of people do you think you need to spend more time listening to?
I love that question. Again, my answer is like everyone. I mean, it might be obvious, but I still just don't think I can get enough listening to the folks in the nonprofit sector. I think there's a big risk, particularly, you know, like as the company grows and, you know, we're seeing some early success, cannot lose touch with why we're doing and who we're doing it for.
Yeah.
And to ever come out thinking like we're the authority is just not, I think I have never come in being like, hey, Aaron, I'm going to tell you how to run your nonprofit, 10 ways to run your nonprofit from the expert, Mitch Stein. Like that is so not my vibe. I want to be a conduit, right? And like a bringing other people's expertise to bear and sharing that with the world. So I just think forever and always, I need to be on the ground learning and talking to more folks at nonprofits. And what I would love is to make that conversation less about Pond, because I think most people justifiably want to be like, okay, tell me why you're here. Like, what's Pond? Yeah. And I would so much rather be able to just sit down and be like, no, you tell, like, what's going on with you? Back to the mom test, right? Like, I want to just learn from people as opposed to getting an unavoidably biased reaction. because they, when you're talking to someone, especially when you know that they're a startup founder and they put it all on the line to create this thing, how easy is it going to be for you to be like, actually, that sounds useless, right? Like, you're never going to be like, great job, keep it up.
Yeah. Well, thanks for answering those questions, because I realize they're kind of vulnerable when you ask people, tell us about how you fail. Tell us about how you need to do this better. But that's good. I think it ties in with our theme here of like, we all need to be humble and we all have ways to grow and learn. So that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for your time today. This has been a lot of fun. One more time, so if people know where to go, if people want to check out Pond, tell them where they can find you.
Yeah, tell all your friends. It's joinpond.com. I'm Mitch Stein. You just type in Mitch Stein on LinkedIn. I guarantee I better be the first person that comes up, or I haven't been doing a good job. And my email is just Mitch, M-I-T-C-H, at joinpond.com. And Aaron, I know you're relatively new to podcasting. You are an incredibly thoughtful host. I've been on a lot of interviews, and you did a really good job. So I appreciate the thoughtful questions.
Yeah, very good. Well, I know you usually put other people on the spot at the end and say, ask me a question. If you want to ask me anything, you can. But and we're going long, so I may have to put some of this in bonus content or something. But yeah, anything cool. You can ask me or anything.
Oh my God,
for you.
I would love to. Okay. Okay, I have two questions for you. My first one is, what's been the most surprising thing that you've learned from getting into the podcast gig?
Yeah. The thing that I keep telling people, and I sort of knew this about myself, was that I'm not a thoughtful person in terms of like from point A to point B. I feel like when I ask questions that they're so long and meandering, like I have to say like, well, with these seven caveats, and let me tell you the story about why I'm asking this. And that's kind of, you know, people that know me are like, well, that's how you kind of are in conversations. But like, as I go back to edit, I realize how much I'm like that. And I'm like, gosh, I spend more time editing myself than I do my guests, because I feel like I don't ask straightforward questions. So that's been helpful. Because,
yeah.
You know, I think it's helped me ask a little better questions over time to like be more pointed.
Yeah.
And so I did send you questions ahead of time, and I'm trying to do better at just reading the question I wrote.
Okay. And then my second question is a little bit less straightforward, but I'm so impressed with your ability to invite not necessarily criticism, but like different viewpoints on faith. And I think, what does the word faith mean? It means you have like an unarguable belief in something, even if you can't necessarily prove it. And so like, to me, I find it fascinating that you're so open and inviting of different points of view, even on something that's supposed to be unquestionable. And so I guess I would love to hear how you manage that like internal dialogue for yourself to be like, I want to invite other points of view. Do you find it makes your own faith stronger? Like it helps you understand other people's perspectives, so you have deeper belief?
Yeah. I think for me, I mean, I think again, I grew up in sort of a branch of Christianity where it was more, you know, like evangelical, things are black and white. And then when I came to college, I think I found Christians who were taking their faith seriously, but they were also like living in the gray area. And when I got into like learning how the Bible came about and learning how, you know, you have these different manuscripts and how translators are making judgment calls about how we translate things. And like, well, what if there's discrepancies between this parchment and that parchment? I just realized that like, I had my own faith experience and I have my own strong beliefs. I'm still a strong believer in Jesus. And I find a lot of other people too, that are just like, I still love Jesus. I love the Jesus that I read about in the Gospels. And I've had a transformative life experience. And so that's what keeps me part of this faith community, because it's meaningful to me. And I believe it does have power to transform the world. But at the same time too, to act as if like I have all the right answers and I'm in the black and like you're in the white and you don't have any of the right answers. I think it's more complicated than that. And so part of it for me is like, is leaning into, again, like learning from people like you. I don't have all the answers, and I want to hear more from your story and why was it harmful for you? And why was it traumatic for you? And if I'm going to be a part of a faith community moving forward, like how do I make sure that we don't do that? next year, 10 years from now, or 50 years from now? And I want to be teaching my kids that. How do I teach my kids to live into their faith, but to live into it well? And I think part of that is acknowledging that we haven't always gotten it right. And we have harmed people, and religion and spirituality and faith communities have been a part of the problem. That doesn't mean that they don't have good things to offer. So for me, I think, you know, it's trying to, you know, deconstruction's a big word right now in religious, some people leaving faith entirely. And I can't, you know, criticize people if that's where they're at. But for me, I've deconstructed some things, but I'm still holding on to some things, because I think there's some things about religion and my own faith and spirituality that are so important. You know, big questions about, like, where do we come from? Or, like, why, you know, why do we believe, like, why do people do good things in the world? Like, if we all, you know, are just going to make the most money, and, you know, I can keep myself healthy and well and be successful and go live on a yacht, why would I care to help anyone else? You know, there are deep philosophical things about the way that the world works that I think some of those questions are answered. And but they're mysterious too. They're not black and white. So I'm kind of leaning just into that more and more, because I don't know all the answers. And but I'm still curious to learn.
Oh, I love that. Very well put. And I love hearing kind of about the evolution of your journey too. So appreciate you sharing some of that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time. I look forward to, I mean, hopefully maybe someday we'll actually meet in person. It would be great.
Totally. No, I want to get on the road and be doing more stuff in person. So I will definitely be letting you know when we come into Tennessee.
Yeah, come on down to Tennessee. We'll get some sweet tea and hang out.
Awesome. Sounds great, Aaron. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you.
Bye.
Blessing. Well, thanks again so much to Mitch for this conversation. I'm going to include a number of resources in the show notes, including the book that he referred to, The Mom Test, joinpond.com, again, the website where you can sign up completely for free. PadronCo.com is Padron and Company, again, a Houston-based full-service marketing agency. They have a passion for working with nonprofits, tech startups, and small businesses. They did an amazing job redesigning my website, and so I'm happy to plug them. I encourage you to check them out. We're also going to tag of the LGBT Community Center of New York, the nonprofit where Mitch serves on their board. So just a couple of the links that were shared, that were talked about in this episode, are going to be tagged there in the show notes. And be on the lookout. We're going to have some exciting partnership things happening between Pond and Unleashed Generosity here soon. So be on the lookout for that. Remember that you can go to unleashgenerosity.org. At the bottom, you can put in your email address and be added to our email listserv so that we can keep you up to speed about some exciting new things that are coming down the road. And then also, please, it would be wonderful as this second season gets rolling. We'd love for more and more people to be finding out about the innovative, challenging, sometimes difficult, but very important conversations we're having. Please do a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you're aware of upcoming episodes. We've got some great conversations in store. And again, until next time, unleash your own generosity.
Will you lift me when I fall? Lift me when I fall. And brother, I will stand with you when there is no hope.